Chapter 18. The Place of the Laity. With the exception of the eventful weeks succeeding the Enlightenment, when Buddhahood made its first tremendous impact on mankind, only a small percentage of the faithful ever belonged to the spiritual elite, whether of Aryas or Bodhisattvas, or even to the monastic order. Everywhere and at all times, the great majority were common people for whom the Dharma was an important, but not the predominant, interest of their lives. In the broadest sense of the term, the Sangha therefore coincided with the entire Buddhist community, consisting of what became known as the Chaturvarga, or four companies, namely bhikshus, bhikshunis, upasakas, and upasikas. As such, it was called the Mahasangha, or Great Assembly. During the lifetime of the Master, relations between the eremitical monks who had gone forth and the householders at whose doors they stood daily for alms, and in whose outhouses and gardens they lodged during the rains, were close and cordial, and a spirit of camaraderie prevailed. The latter could, if necessary, bring to the notice of the Master public complaints against the Parivrajikas, and suggest changes in their mode of living. Such equalitarianism was natural. Their common devotion to the Buddha, and the extent to which his attainments transcended theirs, tended to reduce all distinctions among his followers, including that between monks and laymen, to a position of comparative insignificance. His impatience with the formalistic element in religion, and his uncompromising insistence on the necessity of personal realization of nirvana, moreover ensured that they should be distinguished, if at all, according to their intrinsic merits rather than their socio-ecclesiastical status. Quote, "Even though a man be richly attired, if he develops tranquility, is quiet, subdued, and restrained, leading a holy life, and abstaining from injury to all living beings, he is a Brahmana, he is a Samana, he is a Bhikkhu." That the homeless wandering monk, totally free from all worldly concerns, had a far better chance of reaching the goal was admitted, even emphasized. But that a householder, if sufficiently resolved, might sometimes reach it too, and that in the last resort it was transcendental attainment that mattered, not the wearing of yellow robes, more than one such saying of the Buddha testifies. In a passage tucked away in the Anguttara Nikaya, he indeed speaks of the righteous of all four Vargas as illuminating the Sangha. "Brethren, these four persons, who are full of wisdom and insight, are well-disciplined, learned in the Dharma, and have reached complete righteousness, shed lustre upon the Sangha. Which are the four? Brethren, the Bhikkhu, the Bhikkhuni, the Upasaka, the Upasika, who are full of wisdom and insight, well-disciplined and learned, and have reached complete righteousness, shed lustre upon the Sangha. Brethren, these four beings do indeed shed lustre upon the Sangha." Here, the Vargas are clearly placed on a footing of complete spiritual equality. With the growth of the cenobium and the consequent tendency of religious life towards claustration in the avasas, a change took place. Dharma developed into Abhidharma, and Vinaya, originally signifying the practical side of a universal spiritual ideal, into Abhivinaya, in the sense of a body of rules and regulations for ordained monks only. Spiritual life was identified with monastic life. Though the Pali scriptures, even after having passed through the hands of generations of monk redactors, preserve the names of 21 lay disciples who had attained release, it was now generally agreed that a layman was incapable of the higher transcendental attainments. Arhantship, in the narrower, more individualistic Hinayana sense which the term now assumed, was regarded not as the common goal of the entire Buddhist community irrespective of socio-ecclesiastical status, but as the prerogative of monks and nuns. The laity could aspire only to the inferior goal of rebirth after death in a happy heavenly abode. To the two different goals there appertained two different paths. The monk traversed the stages of Sila, Samadhi and Pranayama, culminating in Vimukti. The layman or laywoman cultivated Dana, Sila and Samatha Bhavana. In practice, the latter were expected simply to give alms to the monks and observe the five, or on the posita days at least, the eight precepts. Bhavana, in the sense of cultivation, the literal meaning of the term, of the mundane dhyanas, though it could not be forbidden, was hardly encouraged. As the Buddha apparently had taught them, the two paths overlapped. The first and second stages of the one coincided with the second and third stages of the other, thus in effect forming between them a single path of five stages from Dana to Vimukti, which could be traversed, according to their capacity, by any member of the Buddhist community. During the period of which we are speaking, however, the first path was interpreted so exclusively in terms of the current type of monastic spiritual culture, and the second so exclusively in terms of ordinary lay ethics, that inevitably they assumed the appearance of independent careers. The laity, not being personally concerned with the higher spiritual life, it was held unnecessary for them to know much about the Buddha's teaching. Restrictions were therefore imposed. It became an offence for a monk to make one who was not ordained recite the suttas line by line. Pali Patimokkha Paccitya number 4. Shariputra was represented as consoling Anathapindika on his deathbed with a religious talk and telling him, when he had shed tears of emotion, that such teachings were not communicated to the white-robed householders, but only to those who had gone forth. This virtual exclusion of the laity from spiritual life, resulting in the identification of the Sangha with the monastic order, did not pass unchallenged. The Buddha had, incontestably, exhorted his first 60 disciples to wander about, quote, for the good of the many, for the happiness of the many, Bahujana Hitaya, Bahujana Sukhaya. Shariputra's alleged remark was, as a generalization, even untrue, being contradicted by the Buddha's own practice as recorded in, for example, the Atikavagga and the Parayanavagga, the oldest portions of the Suttanipata, wherein various Brahmins ask him, and he answers, questions on the profoundest of themes. In any case, far from being wholly dependent on the monks for their knowledge of the Dharma, the laity possessed certain unsystematized traditions of their own regarding the Buddha's life and teachings. Handed down not from master to disciple, but from father to son. They were therefore unwilling to accept the position of second-class Buddhists, or to participate in the spiritual life of the community merely to the extent of acquiring punya, or merit, by patronizing and supporting the monks. Even though it might be for them a remoter possibility to be consummated only after innumerable lives, they persisted in regarding supreme enlightenment as their proper goal, not rebirth as a deva, or even the attainment of arhantship in the current monastic sense. In this aspiration, they enjoyed the sympathy of a section of the monks themselves, many of whom felt that an exclusively monastic interpretation of Buddhism in terms of Abhidharma and Abhivinaya, besides failing to do full justice to the depth and universality of the Master's teachings, suffered from the further defect of ignoring the splendid lessons of his personal example. Between 100 and 200 years after the Parinirvana, these tensions in the Buddhist community resulted in a schism. Despite its crucial importance, the traditions regarding this event are late unreliable, and far from unanimous, there being no concurrence of testimony as to the initiators of the break, its immediate cause, its venue, and the age in which it took place. Fortunately, the identity of the parties involved and the general nature of the grounds of difference between them, as disclosed partly by their subsequent development as independent schools, is perfectly clear, and this is all that concerns us now. The Staviravada, or School of the Elders, that is, of the senior monks, who are represented as Arhants, was the extreme monastic party, according to whom Buddhism was primarily, if not exclusively, a religion for monks, and who not only insisted that they alone had the right of determining what was Buddhism and what was not, but sought to impose their own one-sided version of the master's teaching on the entire Buddhist community. On the other side stood the Mahasanghikas, or those of the Great Order, or the Great Assemblists. They were the liberal party. Unlike their opponents, they did not represent only the more conservative, elderly Cenobites, but, as their name suggests, all the four Vargas. They maintained that, the Dharma having been preached for the benefit of every man and every woman, irrespective of socio-ecclesiastical status, the right of determining the true nature of the religion inhered in the whole Buddhist community, not in any one section of it exclusively, and that in compiling a standard version of the Master's teaching, all surviving traditions should be taken into account, including those current among the laity. They also felt that there should be a common spiritual ideal, not a higher one for monks and nuns, and a lower one for lay people. As the Mahasanghikas were, by all accounts, the larger party, they probably represented contemporary Buddhist thought more faithfully than the Staviravadins, who consisted not even of all monks, but only of some of the senior members belonging to a particular group of avasas. Once begun, the process of division could not be checked. Out of the Staviravada arose, in the course of the next century or two, a succession of schools, afterwards known collectively to their opponents as the Hinayana, or Little Way. Similarly, among the Mahasanghikas, there sprang up various schools which gave rise to, and partly merged with, a movement terming itself the Mahayana, or Great Way, which, taking its stand on the more liberal and Catholic aspects of the tradition, aimed at not less than a complete restatement of the Buddha's message, in terms more in keeping with its original spirit. Whether conservative or liberal, however, none of the schools could afford to ignore the fact that the monastic order was economically dependent on the laity, whether in the form of the general public, a few wealthy burgesses and merchants, or the king. A complete separation, even in the religious sphere, between the two monastic and the two lay Vargas was, therefore, as unthinkable as a complete identification. A place for the aspirations of the laity had to be found. Eventually, owing to both the necessities of their common economic situation and the interactions which took place between them, the Hinayana and the Mahayana worked out solutions to the problem, which, certainly in India, and to a large extent in the rest of Asia too, in practice coincided, to a greater extent than the difference between their respective attitudes might have led one to expect. The Mahayana solution was the more radical, impelled by the universalism and optimism that had given it birth. It evolved for all followers of the Buddha a common spiritual ideal, which, integrating devotion and understanding, derived inspiration as much from the living personal example of the Buddha as from the records of his teaching. This was the Bodhisattva ideal. At the same time, it worked out a common path, the path of the 6 or 10 paramitas, which was in fact a revised and enlarged edition of the old series of stages from Dana to Pranya. By restoring this ideal and this path to their proper place at the very centre of the Buddha's teaching, whence, as from a heart, flowed the lifeblood of the religion, as well as by stressing the fact that all, whether monks or laymen, were bodhisattvas, and thus potential Buddhas, the Mahayana was able to lessen the tensions between the Vargas, which were now united through the pursuit of a common spiritual objective by means of the same or similar spiritual methods. This meant that for the Mahayana, the Mahasangha coincided with the Bodhisattva Sangha in the widest sense of the latter term. The lay Buddhist ideal was no longer embodied in a figure such as Anathapindika, patron and supporter of the order in the Buddha's day, but in Vimalakirti, the wealthy householder of Vaishali, the profundity of whose spiritual understanding was such that he could give a lesson in wisdom even to the Bodhisattva Manjushri. As time went on, a common Vinaya for all Bodhisattvas, whether monks or laymen, was also evolved. Though much less systematized than its Hinayana counterpart, as from the very nature of the Mahayana it had to be the case, it included both an ordination ceremony and a code of discipline. The first of these, known as the Bodhisattva Samvara, could be conferred by any spiritually qualified bodhisattva on any person in whom the bodhicitta, the will to enlightenment, had arisen. Though longer than the Upasampada Samvara, it was concerned, as the following short extract reveals, less with the punctilious observance of ceremonial minutiae than with the promotion of a certain type of spiritual attitude. I, in brackets person's name, who have thus caused the thought of enlightenment to arise, accept the infinite world of living beings as my mother, father, sister, brother, son, daughter, and any other blood relations, and having accepted them as far as is in my power, strength and knowledge, I cause the roots of goodness to grow in them. From now on, whatever gift I shall give, or moral rule I shall keep, or act of patience I shall perform, acting vigorously, or whatever meditation I shall attain, or acting with wisdom shall learn skill and means, all that shall be for the profit and welfare of living beings. And having undertaken to win supreme perfect enlightenment, and having done homage to those bodhisattvas of great mercy who have entered the great stage, I go forth after them. Having gone forth, a bodhisattva am I, a bodhisattva. From now on, may my teacher support me. If no teacher was available, self-ordination was, as an exceptional measure, permitted. The code of discipline, known as the Bodhisattva Shila, seems to have been derived partly from its Hinayana counterpart, the Pratimoksha, and partly from passages in the Mahayana Sutras, dealing with the life and duties of the Bodhisattva, of the type which Shantideva collected and arranged in his Shiksha Samuchaya, or Compendium of Instruction. The possibility that the Bodhisattva Shila is based on an early pre-cenobitical form of the Hinayana Pratimoksha, current among the Mahasanghikas and their offshoots, should not be overlooked. According to the Brahmajala Bodhisattva Shila Sutra, or Grand Net of the Bodhisattva's Precepts, a work of great influence and authority in China and Japan, one who has received the Bodhisattva ordination should observe 10 major and 48 minor rules of conduct. The first four major rules are identical with the four Parajikas. 1. Trading in intoxicating drinks or inducing others to do the same. 2. divulging the offences committed or the way in which they were committed by a householder, bhikshu, bodhisattva, monk or nun. 3. Vaunting one's own qualities and disparaging others. 4. Giving nothing to the destitute and even ignoring them. 5. Not forgiving a person who has injured the bodhisattva, but asked for pardon. And 6. Speaking ill of the Triratna. The minor rules are even more Mahayanic in emphasis, and cover a wide range of topics, ranging from abstention from garlic to the development of the bodhicitta. They are applicable, some to monks and nuns, some to householders, and some to all the four vargas. As extant in Tibet, the Bodhisattva Shila consists of a rather different set of 64 rules, 18 major and 46 minor, the major rules being available in two recensions. All these versions of the Bodhisattva Shila breathe the same spirit of unbounded altruism. The evolution of the Mahayana Vinaya, as it may be called, did not result in the supersession of its Hinayana counterpart. After receiving the Bodhisattva ordination, a follower of the Mahayana remained faithful to and continued to observe either the 5 or 8 precepts, in the case of a householder bodhisattva, or the monastic code in that of a bhikshu or bhikshuni bodhisattva, but they observed them in the spirit of the Mahayana. Such, at least, was the Sino-Indian and Central Asian tradition. In China, the bodhisattva ordination, though also conferred on lay people, invariably followed within a few days of monastic ordination, with which it comprised, as it were, an extended Hinayana cum Mahayana ceremony. Developments in Japan were less fortunate. The Upasampada lineage having become practically extinct, so that, except for the Ritsushu or Vinaya school, there were really no bhikshus and bhikshunis in the country, the Bodhisattva ordination in effect took its place. As in most schools of Japanese Buddhism, the latter now came to be conferred only on those engaged in pastoral activities, it became, to this extent, a dividing rather than a unifying factor in the Buddhist community. The measures taken by the offshoots of the Stavrivardhins to accommodate the spiritual aspirations of the laity were less thoroughgoing. They were, in fact, a compromise. Unwilling to recognize a common spiritual ideal for all Vargas, and unable either to ignore the growing popularity or resist the influence of the Bodhisattva ideal, these schools eventually conceded that the laity as such might aim not merely at heavenly rebirth, but at being a Bodhisattva and becoming, after 3 whole aeons of striving, a supreme Buddha. A list of 10 paramitas, less systematic than their Mahayana original, was drawn up in time to be included in some of the later, more obviously apocryphal books of their respective canons. In the case of the Pali Tipitaka, the only one of these collections to survive complete, the fact that the Bodhisattva ideal finds admission only to such books has unfortunately helped confirm an impression that the ideal is a late and spurious one, whereas, on the contrary, it is as ancient as Buddhism itself, and late only in respect of its recognition by the Hinayana schools and its belated partial incorporation in their canonical literature. Arhantship remained, however, for these schools, the monastic ideal. Thus, a curious situation developed in which the more spiritually minded Hinayana laymen could model themselves upon an ideal which, in theory, was recognized as superior to that followed by the monks and nuns. Doctrinal expression to this plurality of religious ideals was given in the formula of the three yanas, or spiritual careers, a distinction the Mahayana rejected as merely provisional, on the grounds that ultimately there was but one yana for all sentient beings, that of the Bodhisattva. As the Hinayana tradition, both doctrinal and disciplinary, had already been worked out in purely monastic terms and systematically oriented towards the attainment of arhanship, its attempt to contain, rather than really to incorporate, the Bodhisattva ideal by recognizing it as suitable for lay people, failed to result in any deep or lasting modification of its basic attitude. The Jataka stories were treated as matter for edification rather than for exemplification, and the style of Bodhisattva was appropriated not to pious layfolk, but more often to rulers who, being obviously unfitted for arhanship in the present life, might be regarded as aiming at Buddhahood in the distant future. The Theravadin countries of Southeast Asia, unable to formulate a common spiritual ideal without violating the basic assumptions of the Hinayana, have tended to rely on a social rather than on a purely religious solution to the problem. Recourse to such an expedient was facilitated by the fact that practically the entire population of these countries being Buddhist, national and religious loyalties have tended, if not to coincide, then at least strongly to reinforce each other. With the exception of Sri Lanka, which might have inherited Indian prejudices in the matter, they all introduced a system of temporary monastic ordination, which, though hardly in keeping with the spirit of the Vinaya, nevertheless contributed to the solidarity of the community to an extent that more than compensated for any shortcomings. On the completion of the more secular side of his education, which might in any case have been received under monastic auspices, before assuming the responsibility of marrying and bringing up a family, a young man would, and often still does, enter the Sangha and devote a few months to the acquisition of spiritual knowledge. An Upasaka, moreover, enjoyed the privilege of repeating this invaluable experience at any time during his life, as often as he wished, for however long or short a period. Wherever the ancient traditions are honoured, a male Buddhist who has not been a monk for at least 3 days is even now regarded as scarcely human and certainly not fully educated. The Bhikshuni ordination having died out in the Theravadin countries, the system does not extend to women. Its popularity even among the male section of the community has, however, sufficed to ensure a general understanding of and sympathy with the monastic vocation and an appreciation of its special requirements, which are of immense value in creating among the laity a feeling of participation in the spiritual life of the religion. The system has also been largely responsible for the wide diffusion of elementary religious knowledge in those parts of the Theravadin world where it obtains. Just as it was impossible for the Hinayana, even at its most rigid, entirely to ignore the higher aspirations of the laity, so the Mahayana, even in its most liberal form, could not overlook the fact that it was easier for a monk to be a bodhisattva than a layman, and that there existed, in consequence, a real difference between the monastic order and the community of lay devotees. According to the Mahayana, this difference was socio-ecclesiastical rather than spiritual, or, if spiritual, one of degree only, not of kind. For the classical Hinayana, the danger consisted in making too absolute a distinction between bhikshus and upasakas, and interpreting Buddhism too exclusively in terms of monasticism. For the Mahayana, it lay rather in confounding the spiritual with the socio-ecclesiastical order of things, in such a way that the Sangha, capital S, was submerged in the laity, albeit from opposite extremes. Each of these two great traditions in practice tended, when dealing with the laity, to converge upon a common mean position. This, in combination with the facts previously mentioned, was responsible for the creation of a common pattern of Sangha-laity relations throughout practically the entire Buddhist world. Though the Sangha in Mahayana lands may be characterized more by compassionate participation in the affairs of secular life, and the Sangha in Theravadin lands more by cool aloofness from them, such a difference of emphasis by no means obscures the fact that, whether in Sri Lanka or Tibet, Burma or Vietnam, Buddhist laymen and laywomen everywhere look up to the members of the Sangha as to their elder brothers in religion, reverencing them as one and two, their teachers, both spiritual and secular, as three, objects of devotion, as four, sources of merit, as five, a means of magical protection and blessing, and as six, their trusted advisers in worldly affairs. One. Since they devote not a part, but the whole of their time to the study and practice of the Dharma, the standard of religious knowledge and spiritual experience is naturally higher among monks than laymen. Consequently, though a bhikshu sometimes has a spiritually advanced upasaka for his guru, especially in the Mahayana countries, the lay community as a whole stands in a relation of discipleship to the Sangha, the members of which function primarily as spiritual teachers, and are honoured as such. Instruction in the Dharma is imparted in various ways. One of the most ancient and popular is the religious discourse, which the preacher delivers sitting cross-legged on a special raised seat, and which may consist of an exposition of the scriptures, of edifying stories and moral exhortations, of hints on the practice of meditation, or of an original presentation of the doctrine. Whatever its theme, such a discourse is distinguished from an ordinary lecture by an ethical and spiritual emphasis powerful enough to inspire the congregation with a distaste for worldly things and an ardent desire for the realization of nirvana. Religious discourses are generally delivered in that integral part of any large monastery, the preaching hall. Sometimes they are delivered in the homes of the laity. On such occasions, they often follow a ceremonial food offering, bhojana dana, to one or more monks, a practice symbolic of the system of mutual dependence, wherein upasakas support bhikshus with the gift of material things, amisa dana, and bhikshus, in return, sustain upasakas with that greatest of all gifts, the gift of the Dharma, Dhamma Dana. The monks are not only preachers, but writers. For the benefit of the laity, they translate the scriptures into the vernacular, compose religious songs and stories and dramas, compile tracts and manuals, and engage in a variety of other literary undertakings. Nor is the importance of visual aids to religious education unknown. Through sculptured images of the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas, and mural paintings such as those at Ajanta, where incidents from the scriptures are vividly depicted, generations of monk artists have sought to impress the facts of the master's life and the truths of his teaching upon the minds even of the illiterate. Religious instruction is also imparted through special classes and courses, the so-called Meditation Week being particularly popular in some areas. Being endowed with a greater mobility and freedom of action than the laity, the monks are moreover able not only to consolidate the Dharma at home, but to propagate it abroad. Apart from the intermittent patronage of kings, The story of the spread of Buddhism throughout Asia is largely that of the missionary enterprise of individual members of the Sangha. As the most literate section of the community, the monks tended to function not only as spiritual, but as secular teachers. Once these scriptures had been committed to writing, an event that occurred about 4 centuries after the Parinirvana, literacy became almost a Buddhist virtue. Many Mahayana sutras contain colophons detailing the merit to be derived from copying them. Peeling your own skin for paper, says Lochana Buddha in the Brahmajala Bodhisattva Shila Sutra, with blood for your ink stick and using spinal fluid for the water to mix it, using your own bones for a pen, you should copy out the precepts of the Buddha. With exhortations such as these ringing in its ears, it is hardly astonishing that wherever the Sangha penetrated, literacy was encouraged and education became more widespread. The monasteries, both large and small, were simultaneously centres of spiritual life, of cultural activity, and of learning. If the standard of popular education is even today higher in the Buddhist than in the non-Buddhist regions of Asia, it is due mainly to the fact that, in the former, the village temple has been for centuries the village school. Individual monks often ranked as poets and artists with the most celebrated. Sri Rahula, the best classical Sinhalese poet, was Sangha Raja of Sri Lanka, while Milarepa enjoys the double distinction of being both the greatest poet and the greatest yogin of Tibet. The earliest and at least the second best epic and dramatic poet to have written in Sanskrit was Ashvaghosha, a Buddhist monk. In China and Japan, among hundreds hardly less illustrious, there was Wu Taozu, the poet-painter, whose dragon flew away as soon as he had painted in its eyes, and Kobo Daishi, the founder of the Shingon Shu, a man of many-sided religious and artistic genius, who is traditionally credited with the invention of the Japanese system of syllabic writing. Apart from educational and cultural activities, the monks also engage in social work. Some, inspired by the Bodhisattva ideal, and desirous of alleviating suffering, studied medicine and gave free treatment to the sick. Others built roads and bridges, introduced useful crafts and arts, and popularized improved methods of agriculture. Three, inasmuch as the monks not only preach the Dharma, but practice it more intensively than anybody else, they become objects of devotion to the laity. This is natural. The impulse to admire, to revere and worship is deep-rooted in the human psyche, and requires for its full satisfaction as concrete an embodiment of one's ideals as possible. The Buddhas, in their golden aureoles, tend to appear remote, perhaps a little unreal, to the average man and woman. Entangled in doctrinal formulas and submerged beneath layers of scholastic commentary, the Dharma seems abstruse. The members of the Arya Sangha, and even the Bodhisattvas, recede into the sunset glow of the legendary past. Only the bhikshus, the members of the monastic order, fall within range of the layman's experience. From them he hears the Dharma. In their lives he sees more intelligence, more kindness, more self-control, in short, a fuller realization of the Buddhist ideal than in his own. Thus seeing, his faith in the three jewels is confirmed and strengthened. Throughout the Buddhist world, therefore, the laity treats the Sangha with a respect and devotion that at times astonishes the outsider. In a thoroughly orthodox community, the most junior bhikshu takes precedence over kings. No one sits on a higher level than a bhikshu, or sits while he stands. Particularly on formal occasions, the members of the Sangha are commonly saluted with a threefold prostration. In several Buddhist lands, special honorific speech forms are used in addressing monks or referring to them. 4. Dana, or giving, the first paramita, was a virtue to be practiced in one form or another by the whole Buddhist community. From ancient times, the belief prevailed that the amount of merit accruing to the donor was, in part, determined by the worthiness of the recipient. On account of the holiness of its members, the Sangha was the Punya Kshetra, or field of merit, par excellence. For, as seed planted in fertile soil yielded more abundantly than that planted in barren, any offering made to the Sangha was productive of greater punya than one bestowed elsewhere. With a sufficient quantity of punya to his credit, one could pass, at death, to rebirth in a happy heavenly abode. The latter, as we saw above, page 195, was, according to the Hinayana, the proper goal of the lay devotee. In Theravadin countries, therefore, the religious life of the devout laity consists largely of making offerings to the monks in the hope of getting to heaven. This is no more spiritual than a shrewd investment in stocks and shares. Carried to extremes, it can even prove dangerous. A layman preoccupied with the accumulation of a private stock of merit may unintentionally do harm to the Sangha by thrusting upon the bhikshus articles for which they have no need, or which are forbidden by the Vinaya, or which are so luxurious as to be obviously unsuitable for anyone intent on the higher life. Undue emphasis on the doctrine of punya and on the Sangha as the most worthy recipient of gifts also leads to a channeling of public generosity so exclusive that other deserving objects of charity, such as the sick, the poor, and the aged, are neglected. Burmese nuns, who are not technically bhikshunis, being considered barren soil in respect of the harvest of merit to be obtained from them, are often left to fend for themselves. In Mahayana countries, where the altruistic emphasis is more pronounced, and where bhikshus are not so exclusively the object of devotion, such abuses are rare. Even in Theravadin countries, they are not without their corresponding compensations. Throughout almost the entire Buddhist world, in fact, the practice of regarding the Sangha as punya kshetra, to whatever degree, has for centuries past ensured for it the steady, continuous, and most lavishly generous support of the faithful. 5. By virtue of their austerities, particularly the practice of dhyana, the monks were able to exercise control over not only their own mental states, but the objective correlates of those states in the external world. They were thus a means of magical protection and blessing. The laity, though devout, was generally interested more in material gains than in spiritual attainments. They wanted long life, health, riches, progeny, success in all their undertakings, and a host of other mundane things. Sometimes what they wanted could not be obtained, or obtained only with great difficulty, by the ordinary methods. The Sangha was therefore called upon to invoke the hidden powers on their behalf. It is wrong to view this aspect of Buddhism as a regrettable lapse from the purity of a strictly rational, so-called scientific, original teaching. As far back as literary evidence goes, even to what are apparently the oldest portions of the scriptures, belief in the existence of occult forces, which the monk, through a high degree of concentration, can manipulate for the benefit of humanity, is present. The life of the Buddha himself, as it has come down to us, cannot be wholly dissociated from such elements. Neither is the magical aspect of Buddhism the prerogative of any particular school. Though the Vajrayana may be richer in specifically magical expressions, which are for this school symbolic of higher, even transcendental forces and values, magical practices are equally characteristic of the Mahayana and the Hinayana, and constitute an important aspect of Buddhist life in every age and clime. The occult forces are invoked through repetition of the sacred word. The more intrinsically sacred the word, as well as the holier and more numerous the reciters, the more powerful will be the effect produced. Consequently, it is the Tripitaka, or a selection of texts from it, which, as the word of the Buddha, the most sacred of all utterances, is commonly employed. This sometimes results in curious situations. The grosser the object desired, the stronger the desire for it is likely to be, and the more powerful, therefore, the forces that must be conjured up for its acquisition. In Thailand, the Upasampada Kamavacha is recited as a love charm. The diary of the Japanese monk Jojin describes how, when on pilgrimage to Wu Taishan in 1073 CE, he was commanded by the Chinese emperor to make rain, which he did by setting up a lotus altar and reciting the Saddharma Pundarika. No portion of the scriptures excels in sublimity the discourses on the perfection of wisdom. Yet, in one of the most famous of them, the Lord says, addressing Shakra, "If a follower of perfect wisdom were to go into battle, to the very front of it, he could not possibly lose his life in it. It is impossible that he should lose his life from the attack of somebody else. If someone strikes at him with sword or stick or clod of earth or anything else, his body cannot be hit." Here, an exalted teaching is clearly made to function as a lucky charm or talisman. Sometimes the magical potency of a sutra is condensed into a tarani, a so-called meaningless combination of syllables, the repetition of which produces the same result as the recitation of the sutra. However strange such a view may seem today, the ceremonial recitation of the sacred texts by the monks for magical purposes has ever been regarded in all Buddhist countries as an important public service, for performing which the Sangha was entitled to the gratitude of the laity. Indeed, the mere presence of a body of austere and saintly monks exerted, it was believed, a beneficial influence on the entire national economy, and acted as an insurance against such calamities as fire, flood, epidemics, earthquakes, and invasion. Monks were therefore regarded as a national asset. Six. On the principle that the spectator sees more of the game than the players, the monks, with their more detached attitude towards life, often had a clearer and a more balanced understanding even of worldly affairs than the laity. They were therefore greatly in demand as advisers. In a traditional Buddhist community, no matter is too trivial or too important to be brought to them for their consideration, from the settlement of a dispute to the choice of a new site for the village. Especially when sought in connection with those matters with which it is improper for a monk to concern himself, such as marriage, the advice given may be couched not in categorical, but in hypothetical terms, the monk doing no more than indicate the probable consequences of certain lines of action. Whatever the advice given, it would tend to promote the best interests of the community, both material and spiritual. In times of sickness and bereavement, and at the hour of death, the monk administers spiritual consolation. According to some traditions, His care for the laity extends even beyond this life, continuing in the form of instructions which can be heard and acted upon in the intermediate state, Antarabhava, by a stream of consciousness newly dissociated from the physical body. At a time of national emergency, the government may call upon the Sangha, or upon prominent individual monks, not only for magical protection and blessing, but for counsel. Monks are also sometimes employed as ambassadors to negotiate terms of peace. Though invested thereby with the power of doing a great deal of good, the Sangha is simultaneously exposed to the corrupting influence of politics. Examples of politically ambitious ecclesiastics are, of course, not lacking in Buddhist history. But on the whole, the political record of the Sangha is not only far cleaner, but incomparably more tolerant and pacific than that of its counterparts in other religions.